You've put me in a bad spot. Claver will take this as a double cross. I'm unsure as to how I'll proceed.
I'm always good in a war, sir, I said. Just point me at something you want destroyed. Preferably a squid this time, though. Turov gave me a half-smile as she erased Drusus's mind. I have to admit, that look of hers creeped me out a bit. She was already working on an entirely new scheme. I knew I was a player in it, and I also knew I wasn't going to like my new role, whatever it was. The ship lurched then, throwing both of us against the far wall of her office. Drusus's body flopped like a doll. The ship was making maneuvers. I could only imagine what kind of firepower was flying around outside the hull that surrounded us. My dragon automatically climbed to its feet. I helped Galena up as gently as I could, but she swatted my grippers away. She pointed to Drusus.
"That's our chance," she said. "Snap his neck."
"What about the burn hole in his chest?"
"Let me worry about that."
I looked at Drusus. Sure, he was already dead, but I felt like a ghoul just contemplating breaking a dead man's bones.
"Come on, McGill. Don't tell me you're squeamish now," she growled.
She got hold of Drusus, put her knee against his throat, and twisted with both hands. The popping sound made me wince.
"There," she said, panting. "We have an accidental death on our hands, a terrible tragedy, a freak incident. We'll avenge his loss upon the squids."
Shaking my head, I followed her next orders. We carried Drusus out onto Gold Deck. People looked at us suspiciously, especially Graves. I think he knew there was funny business afoot, and it made me feel a little self-conscious. Like some kind of grim reaper, I carried my own tribune down to Blue Deck. There, a familiar face met me. It was none other than the high-ranking bio Centurion Thompson. She'd always been a sidekick of Turov's. Her attitude told me she wasn't shocked by Drusus's death. She'd been tipped off and probably given orders as to what to do by Turov herself. Thompson took the body from me with the help of two orderlies.
"Cause of death, accidental injury," she said without looking. "Mark him as a shipboard battle casualty."
They walked away from me, hurrying down the passage. The two orderlies looked at one another, frowning. One of them was already fingering the burn hole.
"But, sir, what about this?"
"You have your orders," Thompson said. "Have I been unclear in some manner?"
"No, sir, I'm clear."
"Good. Now recycle the body immediately. We need to charge our protoplasm tanks with fresh material. He won't be the last to die on this ship today."
They disappeared into the bowels of Blue Deck, and I left them to their grim arts. Chapter 25 The battle with the squid ships was brief but violent. The enemy vessels turned out to be troop transports, not true warships. They fired missiles back at Minotaur and Cyclops, but only scored minor damage. Each of our ships unloaded a full barrage from their broadsides into the enemy. The enemy ships were torn apart as they hung just above the atmosphere. Treachery, that's what it was, in more ways than one. The fact that Claver and Turov had hatched this deal outside of government channels against the Empire was the work of two renegades. On the other hand, the squids had been screwed as well. They'd doubtlessly been assured they wouldn't face resistance and hadn't sent serious naval vessels to protect their troop ships. Smiling, I watched the vid over and over again. I could only imagine what Claver must be screaming about Turov on his bridge right now. Unsurprisingly, his trade ship beat a hasty retreat from the system. I knew Claver fairly well. He was a trader through and through. He wanted to make money, not war. In some ways, I could approve of the goal. But he'd always advanced his agenda outside of regular channels, and not for moral reasons. He wanted to cash in, that's all. Greed, pure and simple. He didn't care if a few million citizens lived or died, as long as he got his paycheck. Apparently his plan had been to set up a trading outpost right here on Machine World, no doubt charging squids and humans alike for his services. The squids were to have military possession of Machine World, while Earth got all the mineral output. That way both sides could save face and live together peacefully. Come to think of it, the arrangement wouldn't have been a half-bad one if we'd been living with a different political reality. The trouble was there was this little thing called the Galactic Empire to worry about. They had 1 million star systems, while the squids had an estimated 300. Humanity? We were a joke with only 2. Millions of star systems translated into millions of warships, and then an extinct species by the end of any conflict that came our way. As things stood now, it looked like humanity was going to expand our holdings by a dramatic 50%. This third star system would be ours, with all its mineral wealth. All we had to do was evict the squids that had already landed and pacify the ravenous native machines. It should be a piece of cake, really.
McGill, my tapper asked me. It was Graves' voice.
I accepted the private connection without hesitation.
What is it, sir?
Are you watching this so-called battle? The enemy ships are both down.
Yes, sir, I can see it. The squids have got to be pissed. Graves didn't say anything for a few seconds. I thought about closing the connection, but I didn't. It was still open, and he'd made the call. He could decide when the conversation was over.
McGill,
he asked, finally,
what happened on Goldeck in the Imperator's office tonight?
You sure you really want to know about that, sir?
No, he said. No, I probably don't. I'll just let it go.
Thank you, Centurion. Anything else?
Yes. Were you in on today's events before they began to unfold?
It took me a few seconds to realize what he was talking about. No, sir, I said firmly. I ended up playing a role in the drama, but I had no idea Claver was going to show up repping the squids, much less that Turov was going to try to play nice with him. Graves gave me a dirty chuckle.
That's what I thought. Those two should have made sure you were on board before they tried to include you in their schemes. I could have told them that much.
It made me happy to think that my superior had faith in me. I wasn't a schemer. I was an opportunist and a loose cannon, sure, and I didn't always follow orders. But that didn't mean I could be counted on to go along with the random crazy plans of others. I was glad that Graves knew that. I guess those two don't really understand me, sir, I said.
I guess not. Graves out.
The connection closed, and I headed for Blue Deck. My date with Anne had been cut short, and I wanted to see if she was in the mood to continue our get-together. When I got there, the place was shutting down. Anne had left to go to bed. I couldn't blame her. After all, it was only a few hours until dawn. I went back to my quarters, laid down, and passed out. One bad thing about being a squad's veteran was the general expectation that I would wake up before anyone else did. In order to kick people out of bed, a man pretty much had to be dressed and ready to go before the sun touched the sky. I found that part of the job to be difficult, but I did it anyway. Carlos was my first victim. I kicked him out of his bunk an hour after it was officially dawn in ship time. In space, maintaining an earthly clock was artificial. We kept a 24 cycle going, but only so that everyone felt at home.
You've got to be kidding me, McGill,
Carlos said from the floor.
Are the squids hitting us again?
Nope, I said. But I noticed your dragon hasn't been cleaned in a week. I want to see an oil change, and I want every ding and dent buffed out. Carlos heaved himself up and yawned.
This is revenge, isn't it?
He asked. I will admit to taking a small amount of pleasure in the situation, I said.
That's very small of you, vet.
An hour later, the squad was showered up, fed, and working hard. Harris's crew walked in on us. They shared the same mechanics bay we did aboard ship. I didn't even look up when he came in. It felt good to get away with that. Harris ordered his people to work, then stared at me for a few long seconds. I knew he was staring, but I didn't even look at him. Finally, he walked over to me, sighed, and held out his hand to shake. I frowned at it in honest confusion. "Do I owe you some money, Harris?" I asked.
"No, McGill," he huffed.
Then he got a little mad.
"Just take it, damn it. Be a man."
"Why?"
"Because I was wrong, that's why."
This surprised me quite a bit. I could not recall a time I'd heard those words come out of Harris's mouth before. In fact, I doubted they ever had. I took his hand and I shook it firmly.
"Why the change of heart, vet?" I asked him. "I saw what you did down there in the middle of that shitstorm. You took one for the team and it worked. I got out of that place alive. Most of my squad did, too. If it hadn't been for you and Graves, well, it wouldn't have happened."
"Okay, then. I guess we can call off our little feud."
"Yes, consider it forgotten," he said. "You're a real veteran now. You've earned your rank, and I'm willing to admit it wasn't a mistake. But one thing, James."
I blinked at the use of my first name. I was pretty sure he'd never done that before either.
"What's that?" I asked. "Don't sing anymore, okay? I don't think I could take it."
"I'll try to remember that, vet, but sometimes the mood just strikes me, you know." We parted ways, grinning. I harangued my squad, and he did the same with his, but we were both in better spirits. It's hard to work alongside a man who you know hates you. Today, I didn't have to live with that. Chapter 26. We didn't invade Machine World again for 3 more days. During that time, the revival machines worked night and day churning out the troops who'd died. Many of them were sad sacks from Solstice, who'd been dead since the first hours of the conflict. They died on their ship Pegasus and had been waiting in line to return to life for over a week.
"It just doesn't seem right," I remarked to Natasha.
I'd connected up with her again aboard Cyclops, as she'd been assigned to working on signal interpretation duties. It was her job to glean whatever intel she could from the scratchy transmissions coming up from Machine World.
"What doesn't seem right?" she asked.
She was bent over a device that looked like a microwave oven with the guts of it turned inside out. She wore sensitive headphones as she tested various inputs and outputs. Every time I said something to her, she had to remove the headphones so she could hear me.
"I'm talking about leaving people in the queue so long before revival. They'll be freaked out when they finally regain consciousness. I know how it feels. One time I was left dead for 3 days. That's a long time to be dead and gone."
"That's why you keep going down to Blue Deck?"
she asked.
"Yes, I'm checking on Drusus."
She looked at me for a moment.
"I don't believe you. You're going down there to see Anne, aren't you?" she asked.
"Huh?"
"I know you've been going down to Blue Deck every couple of hours asking for her. She's too busy to see you, running the revives night and day. The bio people are pulling double shifts, and that's putting a kink in your nighttime plans, isn't it?"
I tried not to look embarrassed, because she was partly right. That's the trouble with hanging around smart girls like Natasha. Now, I liked Natasha, don't get me wrong. We'd had plenty of good times over the years. She'd been my sort of girlfriend, if it could be said I'd ever officially had one. But she always became possessive after a while, and then we'd break up and things would cool down. On my side of the story, I didn't think I was in the wrong this time.
"Natasha," I said, "you and I aren't sleeping together, right? So why can't I take another girl on a date without you getting bent out of shape?"
"I'm not upset," she said, turning back to her gizmo and fooling around with it. She was frowning, but nothing more than that. "I was just putting together the equation, that's all."
"Fine, fine," I said, forcing a smile she didn't return. "If we can drop that now, I'd like to talk to you about our latest dragon loadouts. If we're going up against the squids, possibly allied with the machine creatures, what do you think we should equip on a frontline dragon?"
Natasha had her headset on again. She lifted the set from one of her ears and glanced at me. I wasn't sure if she'd heard my question at all, or if she was thinking so much she decided to ignore it.
"What I object to is your lack of transparency, James," she said in a somewhat stern voice. "You should be more open with women. You should let them know what they're in for before you get involved with them."
"I thought you didn't care."
"I didn't say that. I don't care from a personal standpoint, but I'm looking out for Anne. She's new to the James McGill shell game."
She put her headphones back on and went to work. My face twisted up into a grimace and I sighed.
"Sure you're just thinking about poor Anne. You wanted to rip her hair out last year."
"Did not,"
she responded.
"You heard that clearly enough."
She pulled her headphones back off. She gave me a sideways glance, then went back to her equipment.
"Just don't break her heart. Tell her how it's going to be. Tell her you'll get bored around date number 4, and by date 6 or 7, you'll be chasing someone else."
"That's not always how it goes."
"Yes, it pretty much is."
"Well," I said. I felt like I was running out of words. "Look, she's been in the same unit with me for a long time. She knows the score. Besides, when did I ever lie to you about anything?"
She gave me an up-and-down look. "It's not about lies. It's about critical omissions."
"Like what?"
"Like Della, for instance. When were you going to tell me you'd slept with her again? When were you going to tell me you two had a child together?"
I was floored. First of all, I hadn't thought Natasha knew about these things, and secondly, I didn't think she'd throw them in my face. But these revelations helped explain the generally poor attitude she'd been showing me ever since we'd reached Machine World.
"Natasha, I haven't been chasing you, have I?" I asked.
"No, I guess not,"
she said, sounding a little hurt.
"Well then, why should I have to tell you every detail of my personal..."
"Have you told Anne anything about Della?"
It hasn't come up yet," I admitted.
"You see, that's the problem. Women like to know such details before they get involved. They don't want to be rudely surprised later on. That's the kind of thing that explodes so many of your relationships."
I thought about what she was saying. Maybe she was right, to a degree. When I approached a new relationship with a woman who'd gotten my attention, I generally tried to hide all the bad stuff. Look as good as you can and keep smiling, that was my motto. Don't you think starting off with a laundry list of past misdeeds might put a damper on a new romance? I asked her.
"Well, yes, you have a point there."
We fell quiet for a time. I worked on my dragon loadouts on a computer scroll while she kept toying with the listening system, isolating signals and marking interesting ones for focused study later on. Designing my squad's dragons, I considered shielding, but I didn't select the option in the end. Shields were nice, but they drained your power very quickly, and the projection units were heavy. In my opinion, part of the point of cavalry was being able to move across the battlefield quickly. After several minutes of quiet, Natasha pulled her headphones off and turned to frown at me.
"What?"
I asked.
"Don't you even care about your child? Don't you even care about Della being married? How could you sleep with her in such a situation? I don't get you sometimes, James. Then again, maybe I do, and I don't like what I..."
"Whoa, whoa," I said, putting up my hands. "Have you been sitting there stewing all this time?" She didn't answer, but her expression told me that she had.
"Listen," I said, "Della came on to me, and it was after we made love that she told me about the kid thing and the marriage thing. After she dropped those bombs on me, we've stayed apart."
Natasha's mouth was a tiny straight line. She was pissed under that cool exterior, I could tell. I had to wonder how long she'd been steaming like this and not talking to me about it. Come to think of it, she'd been kind of cold and distant lately. I guess I just hadn't noticed.
"Okay," she said. "You didn't know everything when you chased her, but... kid thing? Really? That's what you call your own child?"
"Maybe it's me," I said. "But I'm beginning to feel a little hostility in the air. Look, here's my kid's picture. She's named Etta. Here's a movie." I played a short clip on my tapper. then another. Natasha eyed these and softened.
"I'm sorry," she said suddenly. "I was an idiot. Forget I said anything. Everyone carries their private sorrows differently. I guess you prefer to bottle yours up inside."
Her statements left me wanting to scratch my head in confusion, but I know it's a good idea to take a breather when your opponent offers one. Sure, I'd looked through the pictures and thought about being a father. I'd been pretty busy fighting and dying to do much of that, but I'd spent a few minutes, now and then, contemplating these new realities. The truth was the kid was on another planet, and would probably grow up without laying eyes on her real dad. It was more tragic, in my opinion, that a mother had left to fight the legions as well, because Della had gone off to the stars knowing what that meant.
"Look," I said, "you seem more torn up by this than Della herself. The colonists, well, they don't think quite the way we do. They have more of a communal society, from what I can see. They raise kids with a group effort. They don't dote on them and take them to theme parks and stuff like that. People on Earth have a much tighter relationship with their children." Natasha pursed her lips and nodded.
"I think you're right. You should be pretty happy about all that. It fits right in with your preferred path through life."
I wasn't certain, but I figured I was probably being insulted again. I stood up and gathered my kit.
"Where are you going?"
she asked. "I'm through here." She watched me pack my stuff without talking. Finally, as I was about to leave, she stopped me. She got up, put her hands on my arm, and tugged.
"Don't go away angry," she said. "I'm sorry. I'm jealous. I can't help it. The whole thing with Della, that freaked me out when I heard about it."
"I thought you had a new boyfriend. What about that skinny bio guy?" She shook her head.
"It didn't work out."
Her hands were still on my arm, so I couldn't very well rip away from her.
Are you trying to tell me something?" I asked.
Natasha frowned, not meeting my eyes.
"I don't know. Look, you're dropping on the planet again soon, right?"
"We pretty much all are, as I understand the plan."
"Okay. This shouldn't be too hard. We'll wipe out these squid troops in a month and head home. I got an idea for afterward."
Her rosy scenario concerning the invasion didn't match my own expectations, but I didn't burst her bubble. I'd fought squid troops before, and they were real bastards. Just one of them was worth a squad of my men if they got in close.
"What did you want to do when we get home?" I asked.
I don't know what I thought she'd say. Maybe that we should have a drink together in Atlanta and give our old relationship a fresh try. Or that she'd been building one of her illegal bio-nano creatures again and she wanted to share the secret with me. What she did suggest had never entered my head.
"I was thinking you and I could fly out to Zeta Herculis," she said. "There are regular flights between Earth and Dustworld now, you know. They're mostly trade ships, nothing fancy. But it would be at least as comfortable as Cyclops. Relatively cheap fare, too."
My mouth must have been hanging open by this time.
"Why would we want to do that?"
"To see your daughter, of course,"
she said brightly. The light went on in my skull.
"Oh, I guess that is possible. I'd honestly never thought of it before. I mean, all our lives we've been stuck on Earth unless we joined the Legion and were given a contract in another star system. The idea that we can travel as private citizens, that's all new."
"Yes, yes," she said, smiling. "It is new, and I'd like to be one of the first to give it a try."
That was pure Natasha. She'd always been an explorer. If she'd had her way, she'd be flying in a scientific vessel of exploration, not a warship. Then, another, even bigger thought struck me, right between the eyes. My smile faded, and so did hers as she watched me. Della's story about Natasha 2.0 sprung into my mind, whole and fully fleshed. It was as if I could see both of them standing side by side, twins, but one older and wearing a hard, sunburnt scowl, the second, younger, a little more innocent, standing here and looking at me. How could I tell her? How could I tell poor Natasha she couldn't ever go back to Dust World, that a crime had been committed, a galactic violation, and it had been committed by another version of herself, a version of herself who'd been cruelly left for dead in space? "It's a good idea," I said, coming up with what felt like a gifted dodge. "But I'll have to ask Della about it. That only seems right, doesn't it? I mean, what if she doesn't want me to interfere? She's got a new husband and all. Maybe he wouldn't be too keen on seeing me showing up from out of nowhere when he's trying to bond with his stepdaughter." Natasha's face fell. She nodded thoughtfully.
"Okay, you're right. Della would have to know, and she must approve of the idea. It's only right. I'll ask her about it."
She gave me a little kiss and turned away, going back to her work. She didn't see me grimace in concern as I left, shaking my head. Della wasn't going to like the idea, I knew that much. Who knew what Natasha would read into that? Damn, why did women always have to make things so complicated? Chapter 27. The non-coms and officers of the cavalry cohort met together before we dropped. Winslade walked around a central tactical display, skinny arms behind his back, hands clasped. He had the look of a primus, at least, but I still didn't buy the idea that he knew what he was doing. He hadn't earned that from me. The rest of the troops around me were mostly battle-hardened officers. They looked at Winslade with even more disdain than I did. I knew the first time we'd dropped under this gentleman's command hadn't won him any points. The entire thing had been a fiasco. He'd stayed hidden under the lifter while we ran around blindly all over an unknown landscape like a bunch of kids in Grandma's cellar. Hell, it had taken us days just to cross a river. After that, things had gone downhill. We'd ended up taking heavy losses and getting chased off the surface again, accomplishing pretty much nothing at all. While I'd been down there, these details hadn't been so easy to see. After all, I hadn't been the one in command. I'd followed my orders and marched my squad around to the best of my ability. The strategy hadn't seemed clear to me, but I'd thought at the time that maybe it was because I was new to the role of squad leader. But after talking to others like Graves and Leeson, who were much quicker to judge than I'd been, I could see now the whole thing had been a gigantic Charlie Foxtrot from start to finish. Now Winslade was doing his little walk around the tactical display and making a pompous speech in front of about 30 sets of unfriendly eyes. He didn't seem to notice that we weren't in love with him. Maybe he was used to that.
"Soldiers," he said, "we've been asked to return to the surface of Gamma Pavonis. This invasion will be different. Last time we were dropping to evade an enemy attack on our ships. This time we have a clear goal."
He swept a skinny finger down to point at the three-dimensional map. The section he pointed at lit up. A small spike in the landscape was at the center of the region he'd indicated.
"See this startling geographical formation? It's a steep mountain near the equator. Now that we've had time to carefully survey the planet's surface after many orbits, we've identified this region as possessing a heavy concentration of titanium ore. Unfortunately, the squids also took time to analyze the same data. This was their chosen landing spot. The troops they dropped onto the surface ended up here."
His words sparked my interest. I knew that our Imperial ships were built largely with titanium. The metal was light and extremely strong, making it a perfect choice for a ship's hull. With a lead coating to keep out the gamma rays and a few layered electromagnetic shields, you could fly through space in safety and comfort inside a titanium ship. The trouble with titanium, however, was its rarity. A big mine with a high yield would be extremely valuable to Earth.
Not only, Winslay continued, is the ore here plentiful, it's very rich and pure. We'll hardly have to smelt it. Obviously, the squids want this same resource, and have moved to take control of it upon landing.
The officers and veterans around me were stirring. I could see their overall attitude shifting. As mercenaries, we were aware of the value of things. We understood fighting for material gain. A big mountain made of pure titanium ore? That had the troops licking their chops all up and down the line. Winslade surveyed the assembled officers and non-coms for the first time. He allowed himself a sly smile. I could tell he was reading them the way I had. They were no longer thinking about how he'd gotten so many of them killed the last time he dropped them on this foggy rock. Now they were thinking of bringing home a treasure to Earth.
I needn't tell you, he said, lowering his voice, how much this metal will mean to our home world. Back on Earth right now, hegemony is buying up interstellar shipments of rare metals, and they're having a rough time of it. Freighters are shying away from Frontier 921. They don't want to venture this far out. The Saurian princes of Steel World, our best local suppliers, are still unhappy with Earthlings and refuse to trade with us. Rumors of piracy and outright rebellion along the fringe of the Empire are rampant as well, making longer distance runs by traders problematic.
That part about piracy was news to me. My eyes widened upon hearing such a thing was possible. How could the Empire allow these violations? I knew the answer, of course, as soon as I'd mentally asked myself the question. The Civil War in the core systems had changed everything. That was the source of the problem. No one was minding the store out here on the frontier. No one but Earth, that is. All my life I'd grown up in a very orderly political universe. At the top of the food chain were the Galactics, races of beings that were so far removed in power and stature from Earthlings that we might as well have been pond scum to them, and pond scum from a rather small pond at that. But things had changed. The Empire was eating itself from within. The word was that things hadn't gotten any better over recent years in the core of the galaxy as the conflict spread and progressed. The Magua, the particular race of Galactics who owned our local province, were nose deep in the war just like the rest of them. They were slinging ships at other powers, wasting their strength on petty squabbles over who had the right to rule 1,000 stars, give or take. They were losing an empire to win an argument. In the meantime, out here on the frontier, things were becoming more lawless all the time. Winslade said something else then, something that jarred me out of my reverie.
"There's another angle to this," he said, "a more personal angle, one that involves every one of you in this room."
He had our attention. I couldn't imagine how anything about dropping down again onto a planet Carlos lovingly called Fart World was going to personally engage me. But I was willing to listen.
"We need this metal to keep building dragons and other larger machines we've been planning with those tech wizards out on Dust World. The primary component of their chassis is titanium. A fair amount of it has been mined on Dust World, but nowhere near enough to sustain serious production levels."
Graves lifted a hand. Winslade called on him without hesitation.
"Why would the Dust World colonists be our suppliers? And why does this involve us personally, as you claimed earlier?"
"Good questions," Winslade said. "As I understand it, the colonists had originally planned to build their own ship, possibly to use it to escape their desert planet. A grim thought from our perspective as humans. They might have violated yet another galactic law and gotten our species erased.
But in any case, they're our modern munitions producers, because they haven't been stunted technologically for generations by the Empire. In some ways, they're more advanced than we are.
And the personal interest part, sir?
Graves asked. Do you want to go back to the infantry, Centurion Graves?
No, sir. But this hardly seems the moment to make public threats toward my career path.
Winslade fanned away the words with his thin fingers.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean it that way. What I'm trying to say is that the continued existence of this cavalry cohort and others like it depends on these metals. We need a surplus, just to replace the dragons we've already lost. The fleet wants it all.
We looked at Winslade thoughtfully. Everyone was a little shocked. The words, I'm sorry, had never been in his vocabulary before. I felt an urge to ask a follow-up question. In fact, I almost raised my hand, but I didn't. Maybe it was my recent promotion, or maybe it was an onset of newfound wisdom, but whatever the case, I stayed quiet. Graves was asking the right questions, and it was his prerogative to do so as the senior centurion, second in command of the cohort under Winslade.
I see my words aren't lost on you, Winslade said, studying our faces. I know you aren't confident in me as your commander. Not yet. But you like your dragons, don't you? All I hear is praise for the hardware. Look how it performed in this last conflict. Without the dragons, an all-infantry force would have been decimated by the native machines.
We couldn't dispute his statements. They were demonstrably true, and they praised us at the same time. Who could argue with that?
So, Winslade continued, we're not going to take this 10,000-meter-tall rocky spire for Turov. We're not going to take it for Earth. We're going to take it so we can fight in these walking dragons. Unlike our bodies, the dragons must be manufactured and shipped from light years away. In order to remain viable, we need a cheap supply of raw materials. Otherwise, this experiment, known as a cavalry cohort, will be a footnote in the hegemony textbooks.
Wait a second. Had he just said a 10,000-meter-high spire? I looked at the map again, a frown growing on my face. Yes, I could see the scale now. On the map, the central mountain in question looked small, no bigger than a man's nose on an otherwise smooth face. But that was because the display depicted a vast planetary surface. 10,000 meters. Holy crap. That was going to be quite a climb. Winslade went on then with assignments, timetables, and launch codes. After about a half hour, he dismissed us, but he called out to Graves before doing so.
Centurion, he said, I wish to have a word, if you don't mind.
Certainly, Primus,
Graves said, standing stiffly while others filed away. The rest headed down to the dragon bays, planning to pass the briefing summary to their troops. I hung back, wondering what Winslade was going to say to Graves. I still didn't trust the man. I trusted him nowhere near as far as I could throw his skinny carcass, which I estimated would have been a pretty good distance. Winslade eyed me sidelong.
I see your chief ape is reluctant to leave. I'm flattered.
It took me about a second to realize I'd been insulted, sort of. The title Chief Ape had its appeal, after all. But I didn't think he meant it that way. Personally, I would have given that title to Harris or Sargon. They weren't as tall as I was, but were about as strong and mean. Winslade beckoned to me.
Come on over here, ape. If you're going to listen, you might as well do it without straining your huge ears.
I walked back to stand beside Graves. Winslade had a strange look in his eye. He appeared thoughtful. I couldn't recall having seen that expression on this man's face before.
I owe both of you a great deal, Winslade said. You both were instrumental in saving my command. Correspondingly, I've recommended you both receive a commendation.
Graves and I blinked at him, stunned.
"Did I hear that right, sir?" I asked. "You're telling Hegemony to give us a medal?"
"Yes. I doubt the request will go through, however. There is a non-neutral party between myself and Hegemony who must approve, and I doubt the motion will get past her desk."
He eyed us. We all knew he was talking about Turov.
"Still," Graves said, "it's the thought that counts, sir."
"Not really, but I'm glad you feel that way. There is another remedy. When Tribune Drusus is eventually revived, I'll ask him to give you Legion Varus's Medal of Valor. You're still part of Varus, as the cavalry cohort is attached to your old legion. I believe he may like you two more than others do."
I said. "Did I just hear that right? Are you saying Drusus still hasn't been revived? It's been days, sir."
"That's correct, it has been."
Winslade didn't say anything else about it. He dismissed us with a wave of his hand. We left together, and out in the hallway, following the glowing arrows that had appeared on the deck, I turned toward the dragon bays. The arrows weren't displaying emergency colors, but were meant to guide troops through the ship to their appropriate destinations. The red arrows were meant for me, as I was a combat-armed soldier. Graves walked with me down the passage.
"That was weird," I said to him. "Indeed it was. I never would have thought it would have come to this."
"Come to what, sir?"
"I'm having second thoughts about Winslade. He barely knows what he's doing, but he's willing to admit that you and I helped him out. That's a serious first step in a commander. What's more, he did a fairly good job of motivating his cohort to fight hard on this new invasion attempt. He tried to provide us with a personal stake in the battle. I don't recall Turov ever doing that."
Still frowning, I nodded in agreement.
"But, sir," I said, "what's bothering me most is this business about Drusus. He should be back on the line by now. There's no excuse for leaving him in limbo for 3 days.
Graves chuckled.
"There's always an excuse. Hell, for all we know, he's been revived several times and declared a bad grow. I wouldn't be surprised if Turov herself was personally recycling him with a grin on her face."
I winced at that horrible image. The revival machines didn't always reproduce a functional human body. Sometimes people came out wrong and had to be put down and grown again. I'd been declared a bad grow on a few occasions, but I'd managed to convince people to let me keep breathing until events halted my life yet again. Who knew, though, possibly more than one James McGill had come out with a heart that didn't beat right or a tumor in his lungs. Maybe I'd been put down a few times, struggling feebly while I was being fed into the whirling blades of the recycling chute. I shuddered just thinking about it.
"Don't tell me you've still got the willies about revivals, McGill,"
Graves admonished me.
"Aren't you getting a little old for that sort of thing?"
"I'm only about 27, I think."
"Point taken. I'm more than twice that age,"
he said.
"I've been revived more times than you've cut your toenails."
I glanced at him, but didn't say anything. Graves was a strange one. No one took a death as easily as he did. Maybe that was the trick. Dying was like anything else. You just had to do it a lot to get over your natural fears. Graves didn't look like he was 60 or 70 years old, of course. He'd been reset every time he died. Physically, his body was maybe 35, tops. Maybe even less than that. My own body was about 23 by now. I'd lived 4 years without aging. But it had come at a grim price. Legionnaires might be almost immortal, but only because we got the thrill of dying more than once. Reaching the dragon bays, I gathered my squad. We outfitted our machines with the battle gear we thought would be most appropriate and made sure every system checked out. When I was finished with that, I had a few hours to kill before the invasion. I let my squad go on break with orders to meet back for the drop an hour before go time. Chapter 28. Wandering the halls, I found myself back on Blue Deck. It was with a slightly guilty feeling that I buzzed in, trying to get Anne to answer my call. I had to wonder if Natasha was tailing me with either an electronic trace or an actual spy buzzer. She'd done both before. Anne had been ignoring all inquiries sent by Tapper since our last date. I figured chiming for her from Blue Deck's security door sent a more powerful message. I wasn't sure why I wanted to talk to her so badly. I guess it was because our one and only date had felt unfinished to me. At last, the big metal door to Blue Deck opened. The hatchway wasn't like those on the rest of the ship. Blue Deck was closed off to casual traffic, restricted for the lowly likes of me. Combat troops were to stay out, and techs doubly so. The bio people operated like a priesthood, charged with maintaining their revival machines without interference from the locals. I'd never fully understood their paranoia, except for the knowledge that their machines were probably the most expensive pieces of alien hardware we had, aside from the starships themselves. When the door opened, I had a little speech all prepared. I'd expected to meet with an orderly who would be sour and dismissive. Getting past such a person was the first requirement, and I'd done it before. My bullshit speech died in my throat. Anne herself looked up at me with tired eyes.
"You don't give up, do you?"
she asked. I smiled at her, and she smiled back. Her short hair was pushed back, but strands had still fallen onto her face, glued there by the sheen of perspiration on her cheeks and forehead.
"You're just as pretty as I remember,"
I said. She laughed.
"Like I said, you never quit."
"Anne, I know you're real busy and all," I said.
"But you want another date, don't you?"
I did. She was right about that. But I had another more pressing matter to discuss this time around.
"Of course I do," I said. "But that's not why I'm here. I wanted to ask about Drusus."
Her face froze.
"I can't talk about that, James."
"Why not? What's the deal?" She looked over her shoulder and then stepped out into the passageway with me.
"Turn on that thing Natasha gave you," she whispered.
I knew what she was talking about, and I did as she asked. Some years back, Natasha had perfected a device that would prevent officers and other techs from listening in on her private conversations. It even hid your location from computer monitoring systems, all without tripping security alarms. At least, that's what I hoped it did. Natasha had built it and instructed me on its function. I just used the thing. So far, I hadn't been arrested and executed for using it. As far as I was concerned, the device worked.
"Done," I said. "Now, what about..."
Anne kissed me. She did so with real feeling. I was surprised, but I went with it. We made out for about 10 seconds. A pair of passing techs snickered behind our backs. When they'd gone by, Anne removed her lips from mine. Still in my arms, with her head on my chest, she started talking quietly.
"Drusus is on hold. He's not getting a revive. Not yet, anyway. Turov ordered this?"
"Of course."
My face screwed itself up into a frown. "That's bullshit." "Don't do anything, James," she cautioned. "Don't do anything crazy. The Tribune's Legion is deploying to the surface today. Solstice is going down, too. Both Tribune Drusus and Tribune Francisco are still on ice, is that right?" "Yes. We believe she wants to run this invasion directly, without any arguments from Tribunes who think it's their job to command their own legions."
I heaved a sigh. "It's a little worse than that. She's got some kind of scheme going. She doesn't want any real brass around to challenge her, or to report back to Earth on her activities." Anne looked at me in concern.
"What are you talking about?"
Quietly, whispering in her ear between kisses and caresses, I let her know about what Turov and Claver had been scheming to do. She was alarmed by the end.
"We've got to do something," Anne said. "She can't play God out here on the front lines."
"I have a solution. Why don't you accidentally revive her two Tribunes?" She shook her head.
"I can't do that. I'd never get away with it. But I might not have to. Wish me luck."
I didn't know what she was planning, but I knew how to wish her luck. I only let go of her tight little body when she managed to pry herself away. When she went back inside the door to Blue Deck, she gave my hand a squeeze.
"The answer is yes, by the way,"
she said as she vanished.
"The answer is yes? To what?"
I asked the closing door. I stood there for a second, wondering what she had meant. Then I caught on. There had been, after all, only one question in my mind while I was pawing at her. Apparently, the answer to that question was yes. I checked my tapper. It was go time in 42 minutes. I trotted back to the Dragon Bays, smiling. At least I had something to look forward to when I got back together with Anne again. The ride down in the lifter was relatively uneventful until the last few minutes.
"We're getting flak,"
my headset buzzed. The voice was that of the transport ship's captain. Her words came as a surprise. There wasn't supposed to be much in the way of organized resistance on this drop. The enemy had planted troops, sure, but they hadn't taken down much in the way of heavy equipment with them, as far as our techs had determined by studying the records afterward. Troops. Just a few thousand squid troops. How were they shooting at us in this turbulent, thick atmosphere? The ship heeled and slew. I heard a thumping sound from below deck, which I knew was the sound of countermeasures being launched. All manner of chaff, beeping decoys, and the like were bumped out to obscure the ship from enemy gunners. About a minute later, while troops barfed and swayed in their dragons using their grippers to hang on, we took a minor hit. The lifter didn't depressurize, but smoke filled the hold. After that, the pilot changed tactics. The ship stopped maneuvering and plummeted for the surface instead. I could tell the crew had decided to put us down as fast as possible and to stop trying to be fancy about it. Carlos was puffing next to me like he was having a baby.
"This is not cool, man," he said. "We're going to die before we even get to run off this ship. They should have landed farther from that damned mountain."
"Maybe," I said, "but then we'd just have to march in under fire."
"I'll take my chances on the ground. I hate being meat in a can. Let me out. Let me fight."
I understood his concerns, and I felt the same way. One of the worst ways to die was being shot from a distance without any way to defend yourself. When you'd been hit as many times as we had, it was hard to control that panicky feeling. Helpless dread ran through you. Sometimes I wished I was as cool about dying as Graves was. The man had ice water in his veins. We made it down about 30 seconds later. This time the ramp didn't lower itself gently, revealing the world outside. Instead, it dropped with a clang and fell completely out of sight. The crew must have blown the explosive bolts on the hinges. This couldn't be a good sign.
"Abandon ship!" shouted the captain. "Incoming fire! Abandon ship! All hands!"
That was all she had to say. I didn't even get to give anyone an order. The squad was bounding for the opening, taking matters into their own hands. Dragons were fast and deadly when the rider wanted them to be. Unfortunately, the hundreds of infantry we had with us weren't so fast or nearly as thick-skinned. Light troops were trampled and crushed down as the dragons scrambled to get past them. I saw Carlos run right over a light trooper, breaking his leg and crushing his snap rifle with one downstroke of his machine-driven legs. I wanted to order them to stop, but I couldn't give that order. The dragon riders were doing the right thing. The bodies of regular light troops were expendable. Hell, they could regrow these people back on Cyclops if they had to. All they needed to get back into combat was a new smart cloth uniform and another snap rifle. The dragons were different. For the duration of this campaign, these combat machines were irreplaceable.
"Get off this ship any way you can," I ordered my squad with misgivings. "You're to save your dragons. Allow nothing to get in your way. Blow a hole in the hull if you have to."
I think Carlos was the first to exit the lifter. I was about the eighth. Behind us, dozens more flowed out onto the snowy fields. In less than a minute, over half the cavalry aboard had evacuated the lifter. Most of those left behind were light troops, Solstice people who'd been too slow or too abused to get away. The lifter exploded at that point. I saw the enemy missile barrage streaking in at an angle for a split second. The missiles were quite small, but they packed a punch. They slammed into the lifter with a shattering boom. The ship broke apart, sending deadly shards and burning chunks of metal in every direction. We were already running, so we kept on running. Everyone in my squad made it out alive except for Sargon. A twirling piece of debris came down out of the roiling mist and knocked him flat. His cockpit depressurized, and with his suit too damaged to reseal itself, he asphyxiated in the deadly non-air of the planet. It was a tough way to go, with your lungs bubbling and your spine broken. I hoped he hadn't suffered long, and that we would meet again soon. Chapter 29. There was plenty of cover on the mountain, but not much that sheltered us from an attack above. Unfortunately, that's where the enemy was. The squids had entrenched themselves high up on the shoulders of the massive spire of metallic rock. They must have had drilling equipment to dig into the ground up there. I didn't really have time to figure it all out. I was too busy gathering my squad and holding up against a spur of ice and rock at the foot of the mountain. "All right, sound off!" They did, and I determined I'd lost only Sargon. I reported this to Leeson. "That's good," he said, sounding a little out of breath. He was hiding in his own gully a few hundred meters to the west of us. "Harris's group didn't do as well. In fact, half of them are dead, including Harris. I'm going to merge up your squad with his. You'll have Della as your sidekick to replace Sargon." For some reason, that made me a little uncomfortable. Della and I had been pretty much avoiding each other since she'd been assigned to Harris's squad. Partly that was because we were both too busy, but partly it was because I was dodging certain realities. Her triple revelations about being married, having had our kid, and the whole thing about there being a second Natasha wandering around Dust World, I guess that had just been too much for me. I'd kind of shied away from her since then, not knowing what to say. A few minutes later, when Della trotted her dragon into the shadow of the same boulders where I was hiding, there was nowhere to dodge. We were going to have to live together, and quite possibly die together, one more time. "Della," I shouted, "you take the second maniple. I'm leading the first. Split your troops up between the two." "Hey," Carlos complained, "she's a specialist, sure, but why didn't you give me command of Sargon's maniple?" I thought about it for maybe 2 seconds, then shook my head. "Della's in charge." Carlos walked his mount away, muttering something about who he had to screw to get command experience. I let it go and ordered my group to prepare to break out. "We're going to race up to the next point of cover. See that ridge? The enemy missile batteries can't reach that spot easily." My plans were dashed when Leeson called me again. "Don't move out yet," he told me. "I need you to protect the infantry. I'm putting a full unit behind your machines. Walk in front of them. Don't leave them out on the open slopes." I couldn't believe it. "Sir, are you serious?" "The squids are mostly using light arms, sniping from way up high. Light arms won't penetrate your dragons." "Sir, there are small missiles raining down on us. I need all the speed and maneuverability I can get. I can't be saddled with infantry to babysit." "You have your orders, McGill, and I have mine. Start babysitting." Grumbling, I turned back to my expanded squad. There were 19 of us in all. I explained the plan, and they weren't any happier about it than I was. "What's the damn point of driving around this metal dinosaur if we can't run at top speed?" Carlos demanded. "Does the adjunct maybe want us to cover up the muzzles of our weapons, too? We don't want to scare the locals, do we?" Privately, I agreed with Carlos, but I couldn't very well say so. A full unit of Solstice Light infantry was filtering into our shelter even now. They looked young and scared. I didn't blame them. "Okay," I said to my squad. "Della, take point with your half of the dragons. We'll be moving upslope, but not in a knot. Spread out so we don't all get pasted by a single missile barrage. March as fast as a man can run up this hill. If there are stragglers, well, that's their problem." About a minute later, I found myself trotting my dragon up the hill. In my wake, light infantry scrambled to keep up, looking like baby ducks crossing a highway behind a negligent mama. There was incoming fire, but it wasn't very dangerous yet. What surprised me most was the nature of it. Could those be snap rifle rounds? Yes, the familiar whine and snap along the telltale orange sparks hitting the rocks around us, they were unmistakable. The enemy must have purchased snap rifles on the black market somewhere.
They're shooting at us with our own damned weapons, Carlos complained.
A round spanged off my chassis, but I